Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan on News Talk.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, you're all very welcome to Marconi House, which is home of News Talk. We're really delighted to have you here with us this evening. I'm Andrea Gilligan. I'm the presenter of Lunchtime Live here on News Talk. And on behalf of myself and all of the Lunchtime Live team, we're delighted to have you here with us tonight as well. I know it's a big ask on what is the nicest day so far of the year to bring so many people out tonight. But I do understand from recent weeks in talking to you all how much of a challenge it is for you to, you know, quite literally leave your home and get out for a couple of hours this evening. So we do really appreciate your time and we do thank you for coming here and joining us here tonight as well. I suppose maybe just to give you a little bit of a background to this to explain why we're here. About 6-7 weeks ago, Tony Murray from the Before We Die campaign joined us on Lunchtime Live, and he got in touch. He came on the programme to tell us a little bit about his own and his wife Susan's story with their daughter Aoife. And off the back of that, more and more calls came in. Some of you that are here tonight got in touch with us and shared your stories. Others in the coming weeks after that contacted the programme and subsequently came on to share their experiences with us. And then so many others got in touch by way of email. And if I was to hazard a guess, even from talking to the production team, you know, earlier today, probably for every one person who's been on air, we've had the guts of maybe 3 and 4 emails from people who want to remain anonymous, but who too want to echo your story. So I think what we took away from that in the last couple of weeks was how prevalent of an issue this is. I mean, how many people across the country are living with adult children with intellectual disabilities and who really don't know what's going to happen to them. And I think that's why we kind of initially dubbed this discussion, Who's Going to Mind Aoife? And that was sort of where it came from. We've invited you here tonight because I suppose we wanted to continue on the national conversation that we've been having on the airwaves for the past 6-7 weeks. And I think it's fair to say that the campaign has kind of really gained momentum. We take no credit for that. That was led by Tony in, you know, for many, many weeks and months and the years in advance of that. But I think it is great to see the culmination of all your hard work and the people, I suppose, who've been volunteering and getting involved with you as well. I suppose just to give you a little flavour of what's going to happen tonight, we aren't going to keep you too long, you'll be glad to know. But I do appreciate that it's an opportunity for all of you guys to meet as well, you know, and to maybe meet people you've met from over the years in a similar situation, but also to meet other friends and faces who also find themselves in that same boat. I'm also delighted to say we have Aileen Curry and David Hickey, who are both partners at the Curry Hickey Solicitors Firm, who have very kindly given up their time to be with us here this evening, and we really appreciate you both taking the time to do that. And really, they're here to address, I suppose, some of the concerns that have been raised by you guys over the past number of weeks, and hopefully we'll get an opportunity to answer some of those questions a little bit later as well. Just one or two quick housekeeping notes. I mean, if anyone would like tea, coffee, water, please help yourselves, work away, and tea, coffee down the back as well, and snacks. I just want to mention that the toilets are out through the very back doors there into your right for ladies and gents, as too are the emergency stairways. Hopefully we won't need those. I do just want to flag that tonight's event is being streamed online via the News Talk YouTube channel. And our own News Talk reporter, Sarah Madden, is here with us as well. And some of tonight's event will also be broadcast on the programme on Lunchtime Live tomorrow too. And as I said, we do hope to have you out within the next hour. So just to kick things off after all of that, Tony Murray is with me. As I said, Tony's kind of responsible for really kickstarting this entire campaign. I know some of the audience here will be aware of your story. For those that don't know Aoife, you might just explain why you set up the Before We Die campaign initially, Tony.
Yeah, I think every parent who has a child with an intellectual disability, as they get older, you kind of think, what will happen when we're not able to care for them, when we're old or sick or whatever? And most of us, I think, would have head in sand. You don't really want to think about it. It's too. So during the general election, a canvasser came to the door, and she's from Fianna Fáil. And I asked a rhetorical question, well, Mary Fitzpatrick, I said, what do you think is going to happen when I'm no longer able to care? Now, she couldn't answer. I wouldn't expect her to answer. And that kind of struck me, that's the question. And the other thing that is in our mind all the time is, and it's a dreadful thing, but a lot of parents will say it. They usually preface it by saying, I will be really upset. But they would wish that their child would go before them. That's the term that's often used, go before them, because at least then we won't have the worry, I'll be heartbroken. And that's where the name came out of, the idea of before we die, you know, can we just put something in place? And I thought initially it was about money. It's actually not. It's even more complicated than money. But what I've discovered through the few weeks of the campaign is I now can answer the question, what will happen when Susan and I are no longer able to cope or provide care?
And what will happen, Tony?
Essentially, what will happen is that we'll be gone. There'll be an emergency, whoever is left standing. There'll be an emergency. A care package will be looked at. Eve will be probably put into a nursing home or some emergency place. The care package will go to tender. For-profit companies will tender for that. And we know what tendering is in the government. We're assuming the cheapest one, regardless of location, whatever, will get the gig. And Aoife will lose, in a matter of 6 weeks, let's say, she will lose her parent, her family, her service, her social club, and everything that she has grown up. Like Aoife's 42, gone. And she'll be somewhere probably in the Midlands. It won't be in Dublin.
And just maybe for you know, the audience here that maybe aren't familiar with your story, I know from having met you and your wife Susan in your home in Dublin, you know, you've two other children as well, grown up adult children, but I suppose your big concern there is that Aoife would no longer live even within the vicinity of the two boys who would like to be able to go and visit Aoife and meet Aoife and bring Aoife out and bring Aoife to their home. And that's a, I suppose, a big worry if she ends up in a nursing home and in a Shone or
yes.
in Cork. You know,
yes.
how does that connection,
yes.
how is that maintained?
So, I mean, anybody who's got an elderly parent who's been in a nursing home, you go visit them a lot. But what that does is it just keeps a check. What's happening here? Are their nails cut? Are their clothes clean? Are their, you know, are all like their toiletries in the toilet as, you know, what all, you know, are they being looked after? But if they're in the middle of the country and you can't get to them as parents, well, that kind of check, and I said to the minister this morning, I'm not saying there'll be abuse, but it's a license for neglect, and neglect leads to abuse.
So as part of the campaign, and maybe just you've touched on that, you met with the Minister of State with responsibility for disability, that's Eimear Higgins, and I know as part of the campaign you've had quite a number of meetings now,
yes.
with the Minister. What was the outcome of that meeting earlier today?
If I'm being positive, I would say there's probably the beginning of a plan to have a plan. But for the elderly parents like me, that's just going to, you know, take forever. They don't really seem to have an ambitious plan to solve the problem now. And so, you know, I'm hearing stories. One story I heard only last week from a relative of mine in Kilkenny. She was talking about a woman who is 97 caring for her son with Down syndrome who's in his 50s. And you kind of go, like, you know.
Yeah.
So there are 12 places in each of the CHOs. So there's 72 planned places for planned residential. And we kept saying to the minister, and it's our constant line, you can't talk about new places. You have to talk about planned places, because new places are emergency, which means mom and dad are dead. Or can't cope. That's not a plan. That's an emergency which you have to deal with. So what we're talking about are planned. So for each CHO area, and just to give you an idea, so we live in Dublin on the north side. That's the whole north side of Dublin. But just to give you a geographical notion, CHO, I think it's 4, is Cork and Kerry. 12 places in Cork and Kerry.
Okay. So that's the size of the catchment that we're talking about.
12 places doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of it.
One of the things I thought was interesting, and it might be just worth highlighting as part of your campaign for the audience here, you have in front of you, Tony, some of the research that's been carried out. And I think one of the interesting stats I took away from this in chatting to you earlier today is that 2% of people who you surveyed have official written confirmation that their IFA will have some kind of accommodation.
Yep. We surveyed 1,000 people, which is a big survey by any stretch, through Facebook. And it was, so of the 1,000, 2% said they had a formal written housing plan in place for their future. That's the reality.
And what do the other 98% have?
Nothing. Nothing is the reality. So I think I said to you on radio, somebody said, oh, it must be like a dark cloud over your head. And somebody, maybe Susan, made the point. No, dark clouds blow over. We live in a black hole where there's no light, there is nothing. There's no sense of, well, okay, as we get older, there's something. And there used to be the notion that service providers used to talk about cradle to grave. And a lot of older parents would have been used to hearing that. That does not exist anymore. There is no cradle to grave. And what we said to the minister in HSE this morning is that you have to put care at the centre. Care is what our children will need, adults will need. They will need care. And if you don't put care at the centre of everything you do, you will end up in this bureaucratic mess, using language like independent living, rights, choice, all that. No, Aoife, who's 42, three, four-year-old, as many of the parents here will have similar, Aoife will need care. And care is not in the vocabulary of the HSE.
Okay, so thank you, Tony, for giving us a little bit about your own background. And I know it'll resonate with an awful lot of people that are with us here tonight. I might just bring Aileen Curry, who's here with us. As I said, Aileen is a partner at Curry Hickey Solicitors. And maybe for people that aren't familiar, Aileen, with the kind of work that you and David do, you might just explain. I mean, you guys, this is what you specialise in, really, isn't it? You don't do anything else.
We don't do anything else.
Yeah, you're not selling houses and buying houses. No, this is what you do.
This is what we do. Yeah. So it's healthcare and capacity. And our backgrounds are that I used to work in...
I just got you to keep the mic.
Oh, sorry, sorry. My previous employment was in the Office of the General Solicitors for Minors and Wards of Court. And David's was, he worked in the Mental Health Commission and over in a healthcare firm, CKT. So the reason that we came together was to open a firm that specialised solely in capacity and healthcare. And I mean, just listening to your story, Tony, I mean, it's your description of the dark hole. It's just heartbreaking. And I can see looking out at everyone, there's so many people who are nodding that they know exactly what it's like to live in a dark hole. And, you know, a time in your life when you should really be carefree and, you know, it should be. It's exactly the hole it should be, is right, Tony. So it really is. It's so sad and heartbreaking to hear. But back to what we do. So we previously, I'm not sure if many of you are familiar with the old wardship system. There's lots of nods. So wardship, the whole system around wardship was substituted capacity, so substituted decision making in terms of people who lacked capacity. So if your loved one was deemed to not be capable of managing their personal affairs, they may be declared a ward of court and a committee would then be appointed. And again, I'm seeing lots of nods. And so the committee would step into the shoes of that person's IFA and make decisions. And that legislation emanated from a very old legislation, 1871, the lunatics legislation, which in itself is obviously a terrible word. So that's the old system. And
so
we thought,
great, we'd change it, we'd make it better.
Yeah.
Now, what happened?
I should say one thing. In or about 2015, In or about 2015, really positive changes came in the wardship system, mainly in the form of President Kelly, who was the president of the High Court at that time. And he really did do tremendous work in modernising the wardship system. And his work very much, I think, changed how we, the practitioners, viewed our work and thought about it. Was hugely positive insofar as the person's IFA was the centre of the proceedings, as it should always have been. And that person then would their voice would be heard through maybe a solicitor or a social worker. So there really were genuinely positive changes brought into wardship at that time. But nonetheless, change was needed, formal change was needed, and that came in the form of the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act 2015.
So what's the hurdle then that you encounter with that? What are the issues that come up with it?
So I suppose the main issue, I think, is that it's probably not fair to say the main issue, but I think the issue that's most pertinent to everyone in this room is that, so the 2015 Act, it brings about a situation whereby people are assisted in making decisions as opposed to substituted decision making. So it's all about empowerment. It's all about listening to the person, the relevant person, and trying as much as possible to bring their views and wishes to the very centre of the stage, which in itself is wholesome and it's as it should be. The issue, of course, is that so many people, and I'm sure it's the same for your loved ones, they were not previously in wardship. They were not wards, of course. They were going about their day-to-day life with you, their parents or their relations, and they didn't have to really ever think about formalities. I think we very much worked on a next of kin basis, and you know, you'd go to your bank or your post office and you'd do your bits and you'd sign the form or you'd help or whatever it was. But it was an informal way. And I suppose you toddled along and things I'm speaking now, not obviously from a care point of view, but just from a day to day life, you got on with it.
Yeah.
You were the mum and dad. You were the mum and dad from day one. Nothing changed just because the person turned 18 and life went on. The changes now that we're finding are that because the legislation is there, so because the 2015 legislation is there, officials such as in the banking sector, in the welfare sector, are saying, well, where is your decision-making representative order? And you're looking at them going, my what? I'm their mother, I'm their father. Why do you need something else? And I think, and I can just see from the nods of people, that to me is the crux of the issue. And just to say, from the get-go, I do genuinely believe, and I think David will chime in here with me, it wasn't the intention. I don't believe that was the intention. Certainly, in all the many, many conferences and courses and talks that we've been to, you know, with the HSE and the Director of Services, like, I do believe that the whole point was that you shouldn't really go looking for the legislation. You should only go making an application to court to be appointed as a decision-making representative if you absolutely needed to. So if you didn't need to before, why would you go looking? Why would you go now?
And yeah, maybe just Tony on that, and you know from obviously talking to our audience and members of the campaign, is that where it really presents, I suppose, as an issue around, you know, needing, if IFA needs an X-ray, if there's a blood test, if it's withdrawing or lodging money in a bank account, are they the kind of the big things even before we get to the housing in the future? Is that where this really becomes the problem?
Yes, I'll give you an anecdote which I think is really pertinent. So IFA syndrome, she would eat for Ireland. It's just she eats. She has no concept of food. She just eats. Okay? So a dietitian came from her service provider to talk to IFA about her diet, about eating protein. Good, you know. But wouldn't speak to Susan, who was there, Who buys the food? Who makes the lunch? Who worries about our weight? Susan. But under the Capacity Act, the dietitian, who's paid a lot of money, wouldn't speak to Susan. Now, that is a good illustration of the kind of nonsense. Yeah. You do hear stories where Caroline, who's here, who spoke to you, where a doctor did an x-ray, and I think Caroline said, what about the Capacity Act? And it was, yeah, look, she needs the x-ray, or she needs a procedure. So some will say, yeah, look, we'll sedate them, or we'll do some, we'll get around it. Others will say, they said no, end of story, take them out. So there's no consistency in that.
So maybe this is, David, a good time for maybe for to bring you in, and as I said, David Hickey, part of the Curry Hickey Solicitors as well, maybe to just give a little bit more clarity around the assisted decision-making process in general. Like, what can people take away from tonight, I suppose, in terms of where do you go about getting the clarity for this?
Well, I suppose you can start with the Decision Support Service and the director of the Decision Support Service. I hear people laughing. That's not a good sign. People probably here have a general understanding of how this works. It's a three-tiered system. There's decision-making assistance, there's co-decision-making agreements, and then there's decision-making... And then there's decision-making representatives who are appointed by the court. So it's three-tiered. And the whole, as Aileen has said, the whole focus of the new Act is on will and preference, it's on autonomy, it's on about facilitating people to take part in their own decision-making. It's about limited assistance in a lot of ways. So the circuit court judges, if you go into the circuit court and you're saying, you know, we need a specific decision to be made here, and here's our functional capacity assessment in relation to that decision, but we might need other things down the line. Can you give us authority to do that? The court will say, no, the Act doesn't empower me to do that. I'm here to deal with what's on the table today.
So you have to go through the courts?
You do if you're getting a decision-making representative, yes.
Right.
If it's decision-making assistance or co-decision-making, they're agreements essentially between what's called the relevant person under the Act and their family member. And there's precedence for that in the Decision Support Service. And those agreements are then registered with the Decision Support Service.
And just a question on that. I presume then there's obviously a cost going through the courts and this. And is there a long wait then to go with that?
There is a cost. There's legal aid available, but the way the legal aid system is working now is legal aid, certainly in Dublin, legal aid is being provided to the relevant person for independent representation. So a family is coming to court and they're saying, we need a DMR appointed, you know, we'd like to be appointed as a DMR to our loved one. And the court's saying, that's fine, we'll appoint an independent solicitor to represent your loved one, but you're bearing the cost of the application yourself, or else. And a lot of families are doing it without legal representatives. So they're going into court, they're filling the forms out themselves, and they're not using solicitors, which is understandable because the cost is reasonably significant.
If you don't mind, maybe now is a good time. As I mentioned at the outset tonight, we're streaming this live via our News Talk YouTube channel as well. So I know for people who couldn't make it tonight, they're following proceedings online. And we mentioned we were hosting this too in the programme today. So some people have got in touch by way of email. And I might maybe just bring in one or two of those questions that have come in maybe at this stage. So one of our listeners got in contact to say that, you know, they've got the application form. They're still not sure whether they need to do this. The Decision Support Service might give the information, but perhaps you might advise. My child is severely disabled and nonverbal. Would there be any possible arrangements to go down without this route? Like, do we have to go down the assisted decision making process?
The simple answer is no, you don't have to. And if you talk to people in the Decision Support Service, and if you look at the guiding principles of the Act, what they'll actually say is you shouldn't do this if you don't have to. There shouldn't be an intervention unless it's absolutely required. The problem is the Act is now very well publicised. Everybody knows about it. As Aileen says, financial institutions know about it. Doctors know about it. Hospitals know about it. And it's probably understandable that officialdom is saying, well, can I still deal with you if you're not formally appointed in some capacity as an assisted decision maker? So it's a bit of a... it's a bit of a contradiction in terms. It's a very ambitious piece of legislation, and obviously there's going to be teething problems when something like that comes in. But at the moment, we're in the phase where a lot of people are saying, well, unless you have some formal arrangement in place, I don't know that I can deal with you. I don't know if we can behave as we did previously, in other words, on an informal basis. And that's unfortunate. And we probably need the courts to pronounce on that at some point, because certainly my view, and I think Aileen's view, would be that family members continue to have a role, they continue to have rights. Just because a person is an adult doesn't mean that a parent loses their rights, I don't believe. But that's not something that the Irish courts have pronounced on to date, as far as I know.
So this is with regards to the decision-making process that we've talked about. And then we, separate to this, I suppose, have the issues, Tony, around the housing and the future housing needs. And maybe we might even just ask in the room here tonight for just a show of hands of anybody who's in that 2% that Tony mentioned, that maybe has a written confirmation, you know, about future housing needs or arrangements for their son or daughter. Do we? Yep.
Sorry, I don't have a house as such for my son, but he's been in residential care for quite a long time with autism initiatives. I mean, he'll be 40 in August. So I know I'm luckier than a lot of people in the room now. But I am worried about the Capacity Act. My son wouldn't let anyone take... If he saw a needle, he'd be up the road like a flash. And I want to know, would I have to nearly go to court if he'd have to be sedated? The only time he can get blood out of him is if he has a dental procedure under a general anaesthetic, and he's got extremely good teeth. So, you know, it's madness.
Yeah.
This is the only way. And as you get older, you need more blood tests.
Yeah, for screening and everything that goes with it. Yeah, yeah.
That's another thing, actually. People with intellectual disabilities, often their general health is kind of very much, you know, not
compromised.
Yeah, okay.
It's things like that that don't sound maybe massive compared with a lot of...
But it's a concern, obviously, for you, and I'm sure for others, yeah.
And I would have a general concern, of course.
Okay.
Everybody in the room to have their rights and our children's rights into the future.
So thank you for sharing that with us. And maybe, Aileen, just before we move on, just before I get you to answer that question, could we just get a show of hands on the written, anybody who has written confirmation about housing for their son or daughter? So nobody in the room, there's no one even in from your 2% here, which is just interesting. Aileen, just answer that listener's question, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Sorry, Angela.
Angela, thank you.
Thank you, Angela. It's interesting, your specific reference to dental treatment or to a dentist. Just today I had that very same query, and it related to a person who required dental treatment, who simply wasn't in a position to give the consent to the treatment, and they required some form of sedation in order to have the procedure, and the dentist would not carry out the procedure without a signed consent from a decision-making representative. In the particular case I'm speaking to, there actually is a decision-making representative in place who I contacted, and consent was provided, but there was a firm no to carrying out the procedure without having the order, I'm afraid.
So the order would be needed then?
And I'm not saying that that's across the board, but my concern is that it may very well be a hurdle that we will all face time.
Angela, thanks for that. Tony, you want to just make a point on that too?
Yeah, very important point. One of our members wrote a very worrying email, and where she, son in residential, like that, but she wants to get the co-decision. And the HSE are lowering up barristers, fighting her every inch of the way. She spent 15 grand. The HSE keep throwing money. They've threatened to say, you keep going, you could lose your house, as we'll keep going. And that's the reality.
Okay, some experience. So maybe before we just come to some of our audience questions, I know some of the audience do have questions here. David, just one of the points I wanted to pick up on, like, I mean, given, you know, constitutional rights to housing, right, where does the Constitution sit with, we'll say, I know I'm using Aoife by way of an example here when you're sitting beside us tonight, but even, you know, Angela's son and others, where do people's constitutional rights sit with having hope of having some kind of residential care or housing in the event that their loved one or parents pass away into the future? Like, how can we have everybody here in the room tonight and nobody knows where their son or daughter's going?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question, Andrea, and I'm not necessarily... I don't know if I have the expertise or the knowledge to answer it properly, but Aileen spoke about wardship, and under the old system, there was a lot of disadvantages to that system, but it was grounded on a presumption that the state had a responsibility here, ultimately, to step in. So, I mean, wardship traditionally was for people who had money, who had funds, and that those funds needed to be looked after. Post 1987, it was applied across the board to people who were just simply vulnerable, and their constitutional rights needed to be protected and upheld. Invariably, it's a state body, a statutory body, who's bringing a lot of these applications. So the HSE will bring a lot of these applications, and often the cynic might say it's to do something that the HSE needs to happen, to move somebody on or to transfer somebody, or it's not necessarily to facilitate a family member. At least there's a recognition in those cases that the person has constitutional rights and they need to be looked after, and this is the proposal that we have. The new Act doesn't really address any of that, to my mind, because it's philosophically, it's trying to do something different. It's trying to facilitate people as much as possible to be involved in their own decision making, and one could say, you know, it's not really concerned with constitutional rights to housing or to healthcare or things like that. The other area that we work in is in inherent jurisdiction, because the new Act has left a gap now for people who require protection under the court's inherent jurisdiction. Some of those people might need to be deprived of their liberty effectively because they have behavioural difficulties and restraint is applied to them, and court orders are needed in relation to all of that. And the HSE and hospitals are bringing those types of applications as well.
Okay. So maybe just to, before we get to some of the audience questions, Tony, this Act is around since 2015, the change, isn't that right?
Sorry. Yeah, but it only commenced in 2022.
And was there kick-up then about it? Or is it just my own ignorance that maybe only since we've really started talking about this in any great extent in recent weeks that that people, I suppose, are fully aware of the difficulties or the hurdles that the Act presents? Or was there much kickback in 2022 to it?
No, I've looked at the debates and the... You see, in a way, you're kind of giving people rights to decisions, and it was all... And what, of course, they never did was talk to parents and say, well, can we run this by? So I said to the Taoiseach, I said to the ministers, I said, do you remember the programme called Yes, Prime Minister? And they say, yes, Prime Minister, that's a very good idea, but have you considered? And they never considered the people who would be very vulnerable, like, I mean, I know a lot of parents here, like our sons and daughters. I also made a point, I think, which is kind of relevant, that... And I have a slight stammer. Now, when I was teaching, people used to say that was a disability. And as you can hear, it's a very slight stammer, but I do stammer. I don't have a disability. A friend of mine is totally blind, is married, has a child, and works as a civil servant. And I'm using Aoife because, you know, and there's Aoife. So you could argue I don't really have a disability, but you could argue I'd never be a newsreader. Because I'd stammer. So you could argue then that those two people have got a disability, but one is a civil servant, well able to handle, you know, and you have Aoife, but they all have a disability. I think in my own mind, the politicians didn't really think, okay, let's war game this out and see, okay, what happens if we have somebody who is mild, who is moderate? And I have to give credit to Susan, who you've met, my wife, because she worked in the service as a teacher and she had a sister with Down syndrome. Susan saw this straight away. And I was going, no, it's okay, don't worry about it. Susan saw the problem with this straight away and started saying, this is really dangerous. So the idea, as we've talked about, that a child goes from 362 days or whatever, no capacity, overnight, they have presumed, I think the wording is presumed capacity. Mm. And then you have to prove that they don't. Now, how do you prove a negative in a way? and it's going to cost money. And you kind of go, did nobody... So when I talk to parents when the campaign is starting, they say, ah, no, no. They said, no, in law, they have capacity. Ah, no, did... So I think it's taken a while for people to realise
this
that
to play out. Okay,
this
I
to
just
play
was
out.
Wondering. Yeah. So as I said, Aileen and David have very kindly given up their time to be with us here this evening, and I know some of our audience members had kind of submitted their intention to hopefully ask a question tonight, and we'll do our best to try and get round everybody. We may not get to all, but we'll try and get to as many as we can. Our producer Heather Blackburn's here with us tonight too, with the Roman mic. So with Mary O'Connor, I think, is with us. Is Mary here? Mary, you might just throw up your hand if you're with us in the audience. Mary had sent, if she's not, no, maybe she's not. She said, Mary Hayes, apologies. Is it Mary Hayes with us? Mary, how are you? How are you doing? Thanks very much for joining us. We're just going to grab a quick mic, I think, here for Mary. Might get you to share one here between y'all. Mary, you might maybe just, you just wanted to share, I think, a question or have a...
Well, I think maybe they have answered before I've asked the question.
Okay.
I've probably got my answers. Well, I mean, my question was, if we don't do anything... You know, I have been onto the decision support services and also some people from St. Michael's House, and like what they're saying to me is that, you know, any reasonable, like my son is severely disabled, nonverbal. He said they're saying to me that if I take my son into a hospital, any reasonable, you know, physician will understand that there is no way. So is it because that they're afraid now that they'll be, if they don't look for this, DMR, like, do they feel they're at risk if they don't look for it, if something happened? And the doctor then said, he never looked for it. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where we stand with it. So my question, I was kind of not advised, because I know they don't advise, but like I was maybe, do I need it? And is there something else we could do? Like say in our will, could we like just say for going forward for our children, is there something else we could do? Could we make could we put something in our will to make our children equal? I know they can't be guardians, but responsible for, we can't do that.
Okay, well, we'll see maybe Aileen or David if you want to jump in.
I'll let you go with that.
Okay, thanks, David. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I think the long and the short of it is that there's only so far you can go in a will. It'll be your will, so it'll be your wishes. But in terms of how they would affect your child, I really don't believe that it will achieve what you're probably hoping that it will achieve, because ultimately, at the end of the day, it'll be your child's decision that, you know, that the doctors or the authorities will be looking for. So I don't really see how you can, I suppose, plan for that within your will. I mean, within your will, you can leave your estate and your... your estate to whoever you wish and to your child. You can obviously set up trusts to manage property in the usual way. There's nothing to stop you doing that. But that's... falls very far short of the decisions that ultimately will be required for your adult child. And it, you know, in terms of where that goes for...
not get their siblings to sign an agreement
it brings you right back to where you currently are, in my view. It puts your other children in the position that you're currently in.
It's leaving a lot to chance, isn't it? That you go into an A&E maybe with your son or daughter, and you know, depending on the goodwill, I suppose, of the physician, if they're the doctor who's going to follow the letter of the law, or maybe has had a rap across the knuckles from a medical council, and is going to follow the letter of the law, then
I think that's it.
I doubt that they're going to let the child or the person suffer if somebody needs attention.
Indeed,
they're not going to. I mean, I don't believe.
Yeah.
You know,
nor do I.
That they're going to. So that's what I feel. If we didn't do anything, you know.
No, it's probably for the non-urgent stuff.
For
the planned.
If you can go and get the consent, they may very well ask you to go and get the consent.
Okay, thank you for sharing that, Mary, with us. Appreciate it. We've Liam is with us. Is Liam here? Have I got Liam? Liam, how are you? And thanks very much for coming tonight. You have a question, I think, for the panel. Do you want to share that?
In, Sorry, cut me off.
Sorry, you're there. Okay.
No, it's just into the future. You're talking about the bill. And my daughter is a member of a club out in Balbriggan called Remember Us, set up by a woman called Nora Robin. Brilliant club. But back when the bill was coming, before it was released, we had some representative out from the government in the club to talk to us. And when they say they talked to us, they didn't listen to us, they talked to us. And again, I know we have two league representatives up on the table, but the bill was drawn up by legal people, solicitors and barristers, and I think it was drawn up to suit them rather than the parents. Because it's, as we say, we're now in the courts, it's all to do with the courts. And we asked this question because we saw all the different categories, and they said, oh no, it won't be difficult, it'll be very plain sailing, and now we are where we are, you know.
So your issues around the capacity as well, is it? Around
the capacity, and also going forward, accommodation for my daughter.
Mm.
Again, she lives in the community, she's part of the community, and as I don't want to go down to Cork or Inishbofin or wherever, you know, when they get the cheapest price when we pass away, she should be allowed to live in the community. We live in the community, my daughter should live in the community. And that's where I'd be focusing on.
And maybe just to kind of summarise a little bit of your question, and I know some of the other questions that have come in, so that we're not maybe repeating too much from some of the emails that are in here tonight as well. But I suppose, you know, David, would peer pressure maybe, you know, and the likes of the campaign and all that goes with that and the people here tonight, and I know I've met other ladies here who've sent multiple emails to ministers and waiting months and up to a year, some told me tonight, to get a reply, like, can that change legislation, or like, what impact does pressure have, if any?
I don't know if I can answer that, Andrea. I can't speak to what the government might say or what policymakers might say. Certainly, for those of us who are operating in the courts and are operating at the coalface and trying to advise people about this, we realise there's lots of problems, and that it's certainly not working for people who have relatives and loved ones who have profound issues, you know, intellectual disabilities from birth, who've never really been able to look after themselves, and who rely solely on their family to look after them. The new act, I'm reluctant to say, doesn't really cater for them, but there is certainly I think the people who were drafting the act weren't really thinking about those types of people when they were drafting it.
Okay. Mary O'Connor, I think, Liam, yeah, I might come back to you in a moment. I just want to get Mary in as well. Mary had a question. I think Mary was worried, is that right, that your responsibility might be taken away from parents? Is that, maybe just give 1 second, we'll just get the mic to you so everyone can hear you. Sorry, apologies, Mary. You had concerns around responsibility, is that right?
Yeah, because as parents, my daughter is 31. And we've put all of this time and effort, as have her siblings, into her development and to give her the optimum life. And now it feels sometimes as if the service providers are kind of ignoring us. I was told last week that she had a psychologist appointment, and I said, God, we're never told about that. It appears that she had a chat with the psychologist 2 weeks ago for 40 minutes and we were never told. Like, how do you understand, how do you explain to Luisa what a psychologist is and what's the purpose of this chat? Like, they're assuming that our family members have a lot more capacity than they have. And it's all in terms of legalities, but it's not in terms of care, as Tony was saying. It is about care. But the other thing that I would be more concerned about is the housing, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. So, and maybe if you don't mind, you and I spoke a little earlier when you arrived tonight, and you explained to me that if you don't mind, if you're comfortable sharing that, maybe you're originally Kerry, isn't that right?
We lived in Tralee. We raised our family in Tralee. I have four children. Louisa is the third. I have two girls and a boy also. And I had brain surgery, and my husband had cancer 4 years ago. Now, at the moment, it's all stable, but it just caught us in our tracks. And like Tony, you bury your head in the sand when you kind of think about your adult family member who's disabled and their future, because you just can't grasp. And I did not know what we were going to do. But then I knew when the two of us got ill, okay, we have to do something. So we sold our family home and moved up to Dublin.
Which is a big, big life massive, change, isn't it?
Absolutely, because all her siblings are in Dublin. Yeah. So at least she would have that security. Somebody was talking about, I think it was Tony, if there's an emergency, say Louise or Aoife would be sent to an emergency accommodation miles away from siblings, miles away from home, everything they got used to. It's just bizarre that there's nothing there. There's no planning. Like, there's a national strategy for housing that's in operation since 2022. That's supposed to be up and running and finished in 2027. We're in 2026 now, you know. And we had to make that decision because we had no choice. We had no other option for Louisa, because when we're gone, who's going to be there for her?
Well, thanks for sharing that, you know, with us tonight, and I appreciate that. Maybe, Aileen, do you want to maybe respond?
Could I just go back to the first part of what you were talking about with the psychology, the letter? What was your experience before the 2015 Act? So I suppose what I'm asking you is this a new experience because the legislation, or is this something that you would have always experienced?
Definitely new.
It's definitely.
And I think it is because a lot of the service providers don't even understand the implications of it and the reason that it's there.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I just add to that? I met a manager of a unit in the gym, and she's bringing some of the clients down to the gym. And we're talking exactly like this. And the manager kind of looked around as though make sure nobody's listening. And what she said was, to her mind, as a manager of a service, it's a license for lazy staff, because they can hide behind its will and preference. And our experience with a dietitian and your experience is exactly the same. So it's the jammiest job in the world to say, well, I spoke to the client. But sure, it's no good unless you talk to you, because you might challenge them. That's the issue. You might challenge their analysis and say, well, we've tried that or we've done it. But sure, your child, no more than any of our children, will ever challenge them.
And maybe, Aileen or David, do either of you guys want to jump in there, or to any advice maybe on that? Or I suppose where I know it's very difficult, and I appreciate you're here with us tonight, you know. So I suppose if there's any steer maybe that you could give for other people in a similar situation. Or,
well, I mean, one would like to think that we will get to a point where common sense will prevail. I know that's very ambitious of me. But, I mean, genuinely, to come back, I mean, as I said earlier, the one of the fundamental principles of the Act is that you shouldn't be making these arrangements if you don't have to. The Decision Support Service probably has tried to do a lot of work in the background, educating people about the fact that, okay, that yes, there's a presumption of capacity, but, you know, use your common sense, look at the situation on the ground and deal with the people in an ordinary way. But that's, so far, doesn't seem to be the way the system is reacting.
It isn't, yeah.
Yeah.
David Gervin is with us. David has a quick question. Where's David? Is it behind you there? Sorry, apologies, Heather. Yeah. David, you had a question around, was it the obstacles in applying for the DMR? Is that right, for the...
Well, I have a few, and if you don't mind, I'll ask. Has anyone, I actually used AI to analyse the Decision Making Capacity Act, to familiarise itself with it, and then asked it a question about how do you think this applies to someone with a profound intellectual disability? And AI just turned around and says, they never thought of those people when they recreated this legislation. Okay? So I then said, okay, so it's called disclosures that you have to request when you make the application to the court, the circuit court. And I said, okay, so what would you need to ask for with respect to someone with a profound intellectual disability? And fair play to AI, plug, Perplexity was good. It came up with a list, and it categorized them, and it was fantastic. The problem is, when I went to fill in the forms, Form 55s, there's not enough room. So my question is, has anyone tried yet to do a long, comprehensive list of requests before the circuit court in one application? And if they have, did it succeed? And the second problem I have is I can't find anyone to do a capacity assessment. My daughter's 30, she's non-verbal, she's non-mobile, she's been in the same service provider all of her life. So fair play to the director of services. He offered all the staff to get trained. Yeah, that took a few months. And now we're in a situation where the staff have been trained to do a capacity assessment, but they're awaiting input and feedback from their professional bodies as to whether they should proceed or not.
Okay.
Right, so I can't even make my applications to the court.
Okay. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. With two questions there, maybe we'll take one each, perhaps, Aileen, if you want to kick off on
that. Okay, I might start on the second part, the capacity part of it. So initially, I think we would have found that to be quite a challenge. So in terms of actually sourcing a person to prepare the capacity assessment, that definitely in the first year to 18 months was one of our major obstacles. Now that's not quite so challenging. We do find in practice that there certainly is more confidence in terms of the preparation of the functional capacity assessment. While there are delays, we do find that, I suppose, you know, the adage that if you ask, the better question you ask, the better answer you receive. So we have fine-tuned what we're asking for. And I do find that the reports that we're getting back as a result are significantly better than in the early days. A lot of our capacity assessments are done. So we have come across many situations whereby we have written to the person's GP and we haven't received a positive response. We've had many responses whereby the person doesn't feel that they are the right person to carry out the report. For example, if we were applying maybe for an elderly person who perhaps has Alzheimer's, we may be told to go to a geriatrician, excuse me. And then, of course, the issue with that is time, but also cost. It's significantly more expensive to get a report from a geriatrician than from you know, the person's GP who probably has known them all their life. So there are problems there, but we are finding that as time has gone on and people have become more experienced with navigating the legislation, that the issues are less. We found, particularly in the last 6 months, there are more social workers willing to carry out capacity assessments. And some of those reports have proved to be quite fruitful. We certainly have come across plenty of scenarios where it's an issue. But right now, it's much less than it was initially.
David, do you want to maybe just to answer a little bit of David's question as well?
On the circuit court.
Yeah.
So, I haven't brought an application like that, but and I think the difficulty with bringing an application like that is that it flies in the face of the philosophy of the Act, which is that you only should be coming in here for limited decisions in limited circumstances. You shouldn't really be looking way into the future about what might happen around the corner. So that's going to present a difficulty to a circuit court judge in terms of what the Act allows. Interestingly, what we're seeing a contrast between the circuit court and the High Court, because the High Court is dealing with discharges from wardship, and people are being discharged from wardship. They were to be discharged, all to be discharged by April of this year, but there's going to be an extension on that now. But the High Court judges who are used to dealing with wardship and are used to dealing with committees and the court having kind of broad authority are essentially saying to the DMO or the loved one, you know, you have broad authority to do what you think is necessary. The wording is very broad. But there are circuit court practitioners and people who are au fait with the Act saying that's going to be a problem when it comes up for review in the circuit court, because they're going to want to take all that power back and say that's not what the Act is set up for.
David, so, thanks for sharing that question with us. I just want to pick up on another online question that's come in here tonight for somebody just asking, are there any figures available to date on how many decision support arrangements have been granted, and in particular decision-making representation orders? Do we have any idea on that?
We have up until December 2025 approximately 2,000 decision-making representative orders That's the most up-to-date.
That's nationwide, is it?
Yes, that's nationwide. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Maybe, Tony, just to bring it back a little bit, because as part of the Before We Die campaign, I know there's other audience members with questions, and hopefully maybe towards the end we'll get to those, because I'm just quite conscious of the time for online people as well. So the campaign, obviously, you set this up quite a while ago, and there's been a lot of momentum behind that, and you've been having, you know, on-off or ad hoc meetings with the Minister of State, Emer Higgins, in relation to this. And I think it's fair to say there's been a lot of kind of momentum around the campaign as well in perhaps more recent months. But where do you go from here? You know, what's the next step, or where do you see this getting to?
Okay, before I answer that, I have to acknowledge that the campaign has been successful largely to yourself and Niamh, who's in the front there, and the team behind you.
Thank you very much, but it's all of the people themselves that shared stories, because...
So where the campaign goes from here, I have said to a lot of our members' committee, we're almost in a sugar rush. We've had a lot of... huge publicity from yourself, it started with yourself, a huge rush, meeting the Taoiseach, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now I think we're into the sober, long, hard graft. And what I would say to parents listening, and parents here, and siblings, joining the Facebook group or joining the mailing list is not campaigning. That's just information like what we're doing. Unless people make a nuisance of themselves with their local TDs continually, not one letter, two letters, and say, what are you doing? Where are we? And use your own example of your child and say, what's going to happen to X? I need to know, and you're the legislator, you need to be asking that question. And until we actually get to that stage, unfortunately, the only thing politicians are really fearful of our votes. And if they see it as being, we'll remember last general election, disability was not on the agenda until that famous encounter in Cork, and suddenly it's on the agenda because the politician was embarrassed. So unless parents are really clever, and the campaign is now going to swing into probably more social media, we've had a lot of success with traditional media, so we have to move into social media. And I think we also have to try and, and it's not patronising, but educate parents on how to lobby. Because most of us are too busy with our children, adults. Oh, you have to be a lobbyist as well. Oh, well, it's too much. So unless we lobby smartly, and you lobby TDs, not county councillors, they have no power, you're wasting your time. And unless you lobby TDs, I'd also say to people, the TDs have heard all our sad stories. I don't want to say sob stories, but that's what my story is. It's, they've heard it all. Stop. Don't waste your time. Ask them, what are you doing? You know the situation. It's been well publicised, well documented. What are you doing? You also have to give them context about your own situation. But going to your TD can often feel like therapy. No, therapy is therapy. Going to your TD is asking them specifically, what are you doing about this? Not, actually, I feel much better. I give them a real going over. They really now know. Sorry, it's gone over their heads. It means nothing. So you need to focus on what you want them to do, and then go back twice, three times, four times. That's the reality.
Okay. Aileen and David, maybe just in a final word, and I know you guys are obviously working and specialising in this area professionally, and you know you're here for no other reason tonight other than to lend support to the campaign and providing hopefully a little bit of clarity to people that are here. Is there a final maybe word from both of you that, you know, in relation to people that are here that are maybe, you know, looking for more advice or difficulties, and maybe, you know, how many solicitors, I suppose, specialise in this area? Is that a difficulty, trying to find people in practising that, you know, do like you guys do, and this is your kind of your portfolio?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. within our area, it's a small community of people who practice specifically in the area that we're in. But I would imagine that because it's in the circuit court now as opposed to the High Court, that there are plenty of practitioners around the country. That said, we do get a lot of queries from practitioners in terms of navigating the Act. But, I mean, within our area, I think it's fair to say there's, in our immediate area, there's about 10 firms or so.
Yeah, I've never really counted. We are, one of the good things about working in this area is that it's a small number of lawyers, and we could talk to people offline about that, about who they are. But and everybody knows each other, and everybody actually does work really well together. There are people who are out there and who are doing this work every day of the week. A final point, maybe it's not really a legal point, but I mean, I think there's a lot of force in what Tony has said. And obviously, you're all dealing with the situation at various junctures. Our experience at the coalface, in terms of placements, is that they're really hard to come by. We can't speak to the policy decisions around that, or the government's view around that, but they're really hard to come by. They're often not ideal. A court is often presented with just one option, and it's basically this is it. We don't have anything else. It's not like they're being presented with two or three options and it's the pros and cons. They're very difficult to obtain. Often it arises in emergency situations, and it is the voluntary sector and the private sector that is filling this space. It's really difficult.
Is this tipping point for the campaign, do you think?
How do you mean, sorry?
Is it likely that, you know, is it your hope that it will pick up in momentum? Or, like, I'm curious because some of the online people watching tonight, the online audience members, are wondering, like, have you ever thought about increasing the campaign in terms of protest? Or is that something that's ever... It's very difficult, I can appreciate that, but even thinking of the numbers of people watching tonight who, you know, can't leave their loved ones at home. But
when we set up the campaign on the, I think the first meeting, I said, we're not marching to the Dáil. We're just not. The day we went to see, I think, Norma Foley, there was four protests outside the Dáil that day. You kind of go, sorry, we'd be the fifth, do you think we'd get anything? Or, you know, Trump does something mad and we're blowing off the news, and that's like, you know, so you can't go down that road. I think it has to be a mature campaign. It needs to be driven by, you could say, it started with passion. Now it has to be driven by facts, analysis, and political critique. And the threat of the general election is in 2 years' time. And that's what we're thinking of. Okay, you've heard the story. What are you going to do? So I think we'll move into a slightly different phase because, in a sense, traditional media yourselves, you can't keep doing like our story. You know, it's going to run out of steam.
We're also not suggesting, by the way, that you protest either, but no, I'm just asking by way of by some of the audience tonight, you know.
So at the end of our email, the kind of signature is... I might have it wrong, but we've no say. We've no choice. No voice. Well, we do have a voice now. But parents live in a world where you have no say at all. We used to make the point, Susan and I used to make the point when Aoife was younger. If we didn't send the two boys to school, there'd be a knock on the door. Two sons, what's happening? Nobody would ever knock on the door to say, what about Aoife? Is she not in school? Well, there's no place for her. So that's the kind of difference that you realise, that effectively she's not at school. Yeah, okay. Sure, she's a disability. Sure, it doesn't make any difference anyway. But nobody comes knocking on your door to check on that. So the no choice is, we've no choice. It's a postal lottery where you live. The other word that I think I said to the minister today, that a lot of people like us, parents like us, use the word lucky. I'm lucky to have transport. I'm lucky to get respite. Mm. And we use it quite a lot without thinking. And we don't kind of go, I don't say lucky about my other two boys. Mm. I do say I'm lucky they live near us. Sure. Okay, that's lucky that they live quite near us and we see them. And they don't live in Australia. That's lucky. Mm. But we use lucky quite a lot. And you kind of go, we don't use lucky for our able-bodied children. So I think we are so conditioned to not having a choice not having a say. And I would say that the service providers are using, and it's interesting, a lot of the voluntary service providers were set up by largely mothers, not parents, mothers, I have to say, mothers. Parents have been excluded from the boards. They've been excluded from any kind of conversation. And we've been disempowered by the service providers, by the politicians. But now they have to deal with before we die.
I know we mentioned at the very outset tonight, like a lot of what we wanted to do tonight was really to kind of continue the conversation that we've been having on the programme over the last couple of weeks. And it was, I never thought at the outset tonight we were going to arrive at all of the answers. But yeah. I suppose if one thing comes from it this evening, you know, you can really get a sense of the momentum and interest in the room. And I can see that even from the online correspondence here as well and the number of people that are watching us by way of YouTube. So thank you to those for joining us as well. As I said, I am conscious of time and I really appreciate you all for joining us. We'll keep on, I suppose, on top of this is probably the best way to describe that. We said that a couple of weeks ago when you joined us on the show, and we'll continue to do that. I know the people here, you want them to join up to the campaign. They can follow your own progress as well online, on Instagram, on Facebook, yes, and on social media. And that's worth mentioning, the Before We Die campaign there too. Can I just ask you to give a particular thanks, though, tonight to Aileen Curry and David Hickey, who have very generously given up their time to be with us. And we really appreciate that, because to be fair to you both, you're here very in a volunteer capacity, and we really appreciate you setting the time aside to do that. And Tony and Murray as well. Tony, thanks very much to yourself and Susan for being with us, and I know for all of the great work that you've been doing in the background. Thank you to everybody who's joined us online, and to all of you for being in the room with us tonight. We really appreciate your time. As always, the email's lunchtimelive@newstalk.com, and we will keep on top of all of this. My thanks to our own production team, just to mention Niamh Hamill, Heather Blackburn, Laura Hannan, David Slevin, Sifra O'Donovan and Jack Lawler, who have put all of this together here this evening. And thanks very much to all of you for coming. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday on News Talk. Conversation that counts.